From Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International, it's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming.
A moment's sleep and the girl I loved was an inhuman enemy bent on my destruction. That moment's sleep was death to Becky's soul, just as it had been for Jack and Teddy and Dan Kaufman and all the rest. Their bodies were now hosts harboring an alien form of life, a cosmic form, which to survive must take over every human man. My only hope was to get away from Santa Mira, to get to the highway.
The classic sci-fi B-movie Invasion of the Body Snatchers might not seem like a political parable, but under the surface, all those 1950s movies about aliens from outer space were really about the Cold War. Today, Russia's cultural influence, past and present, from reality TV to modern ballet. And road trip, anyone? Writer Ian Frazier spent 6 weeks crossing Siberia to uncover the stories from its frozen history and come to terms with his reluctant affection for Russia.
Russia is like an abused country. It was abused in its childhood by the Mongols. This was back starting in the 13th century. So it's a combination of splendor, really, and wretchedness.
Peter Pomerantsev is a British TV producer and developer. In 2006, he was invited to be a player in the booming Russian TV industry. So he moved to Moscow to help develop TV shows based on already successful models from the UK, like The Apprentice. But the Russian television industry was unlike anywhere he'd ever worked. Russian TV audiences were even stranger. He told Steve Paulson about his new job.
My mission was to go to the heads of Russian TV channels and get them to sort of essentially let us make sort of successful Western formats for them, like The Apprentice, Come Dine With Me, Survivor, any of these things that we've known for a long time in the West. So I would go and meet with channel heads and, you know, try to persuade them to let us make these programs for them.
Now, you were brought in specifically to work on some of these reality shows that had been very popular in Britain. And, of course, a lot of the American reality shows originated in Britain as well. How did that translate into the Russian television scene?
Well, I did lots of stuff. I did factual entertainment and sort of classical reality stuff. But basically, virtually all Western programs, they're based on something we call aspirational. They reflect the aspirations of society. So it takes something like The Apprentice, which you must know in the States. Mm-hmm, Donald Trump doesn't in the States. I don't need to explain the rules. So it's all about somebody working very hard, coming top, winning, being really extrovert and bright. And the thing is, when that translated onto Russia, it didn't work because nobody in Russia gets a job through a job interview process. You get a job through connections, by knowing people, also maybe by even paying a bribe. And also, bright extrovert people aren't particularly rewarded there. The sort of the fashionable type of person there, the guy who wins, is the Putin type, who works from the shadows. You can never tell what he's thinking. He's always manipulating people. Bright extrovert people are like, you know, Khodorkovsky, who's this oil baron who's in jail. So sort of like, you know, that whole value system just isn't applicable in Russia. So we found that most of the shows just did not resonate, even though they're very, very well made. The shows that did resonate were stuff. Survivor did very, very well. You know, the show Survivor, which is basically taking people, putting them on an island and humiliating them. And Russians loved it. They love anything based on humiliation because so much of their life is about being humiliated by the state, being humiliated by the weather. And so they can completely relate to that. So there was a real ideological breakdown when we moved into there, which was, I don't know, again, I think speaks was amusing because it's only television, but actually I think speaks of a deeper malaise in Russia as well.
Hmm. Now, of course, the premise of reality shows is that it's all it's not scripted. I mean, this is stuff that's really happening to people. You know, various people are thrown in together and you kind of see what comes of that. I could imagine that maybe there was some suspicion about that. I mean, were these shows actually unscripted?
The ones I worked on were. That's maybe part of the reason they failed. But in Russia, there's a very, very old cynicism from Soviet times about television, because in Soviet times television was purely about propaganda. I mean, it was just such blatant lies that it was, you know, nobody believed it. So there's always this cynicism about what goes on television and whether television is a trusted medium. And like in the West, where however cynical we are, it's still sort of a friend. So Russians are very, very jaded about TV. So the audience is already skeptical. Then there's another problem with making reality in Russia, and that's the producers. Because when you tell them, look, you know, this is reality-based, you know, you have to sort of cast the characters and produce them, they're like, no, there's no way you can do this. People can't have freedom. You must script everything. And there's this terror of freedom, which, again, I think, you know, sort of reflected the politics of the time, where sort of, you know, democracy was being rolled back very, very strongly in Russia. And the Kremlin was inventing something called sovereign democracy, which is basically democracy without the democracy bit, where everything is scripted. And so, yeah, there was this overall terror of letting things be and a freedom. And that made making it virtually impossible because, you know, you'd make it and a very skeptical audience would say, but this isn't real. And they were right. So reality shows never took off in Russia the way they took off in the West.
Hmm. What about the news shows? How were decisions made? And was it real news? I mean, were there different viewpoints presented?
No. I mean, it's all about the enemy. It's all about identifying the enemy. They're out there without ever saying who they are. So that's the thing. That's a Kremlin policy. You know, that's a very old Soviet policy. They like to give this illusion that they're giving sort of something about Russia and something about the world. So you can often start with a typical news I will start with, you know, we have problems in Russia. Let's say we have an economic problem. It's terrible, but we'll deal with it. The next piece of news will be the economic problems in Britain are much worse. So we're all right here in Russia because it's much worse over there. Then there's always something with Putin, the prime minister, doing something heroic. But it sort of follows this sort of like, you know, chapter by chapter breakdown every time.
You say another tactic was to have the president or to have Putin meet at a table with all the governors. And you describe it almost like Marlon Brando in The Godfather.
You have to understand, Russia in the 90s was completely and utterly dominated by gangsters. They were the most successful people in society. They were the richest people in society. They were sort of the sexiest guys in society. And the people around Putin, his PR guys, they completely understand that for Putin to be successful, for his image to work, he needs to act like a gangster because that's, you know, that's what success is in Russia. And so that sort of defines the way he speaks, the way they dress him. His usual dress is sort of a black polo neck with a black jacket over. That's the way a Russian gangster would dress. The dark glasses, the expressions that he uses at press conferences. There's a very famous expression he used after a Chechen terrorist attack. Is like, we will get the terrorists on the shit. It's a real Don Corleone or even sort of a Scarface type phrase. You know, we'll go and get them when they're on the loose and blast their heads off. And also in the way he talks to his cabinet, he talks like a mafia leader putting down his lieutenants. It's just a style of presentation that's sort of successful. Hmm. So that's why it's adopted.
Now, you also write about some TV shows that they're actually quite successful, kind of a quasi-documentaries. Like there was one about mold.
This was, I don't know if it's changed since then, it was the most expensive documentary in the history of Russian TV. It was very, very beautifully made, very, very expensive graphics. And it looked like a very sensible Discovery or BBC nature documentary. And it was about the way mold is taking over the earth and that we're all under threat from evil mold and the mold will come and get us soon and your children will die. And when I first switched it on, I thought it was a satire, but it wasn't. It was completely serious, hugely successful. You know, all these old grannies were running around sort of the next day shrieking about how the mold is coming to get them. Yeah, and so that was very, very, very strange.
Wasn't there another very popular documentary about the psychic powers of the government?
Yeah, that was hilarious. That was called The Call of the Void. And basically, it alleged that the government had, and this is completely serious again. I mean, I thought it was a satire. It wasn't. It was completely serious in prime time, produced by a ministry. Again, very expensively done with expensive reconstructions. Looked just like a Western TV show. So it was basically about the way the KGB had these things they called sleepers. Sleepers are special psychics who can go into a deep trance and get into the brain of opposition politicians in different countries. And they'd been saving Russia over the last 15 years. They'd managed to get into Bush's brain and realize he had this evil plan to, I think it was, kill Yeltsin or something. And then they'd managed to get into the brain of one of Bush's assistants and stop him from fulfilling this plan. And all this was, you know, given completely seriously. And in a way, when something is said so seriously and so convincingly, you kind of go, well, maybe they do have that. And, you know, there were witnesses there and experts talking about it and little machines showing the science behind it.
How do you think this kind of show plays to the people who are watching?
Well, the whole point is, I think, firstly, to impress you, like, my God, you know, we may be, you know, we might have lost the Soviet Union, but we have sleepers, so let's feel good about ourselves, firstly. And secondly, well, listen, if the government can get into Bush's mind, it can certainly get into your mind, so we know what you're thinking, we know where you've hidden your money, and suddenly, you know, the civilian is sort of just like in a state of anxiety that, oh, my God, what if they get into my mind? And, you know, it sounds ridiculous. It really does sound ridiculous. But when these films happen all the time, and they happen in prime time, and they're told in this very authoritative, pseudo-scientific language, you know, they start to have a psychological effect.
Weren't sitcoms also pretty popular when you were there? Even though sitcoms have pretty much disappeared from American TV.
Yeah, well, there are some, but not many. Russia is a bit behind the loop in terms of sort of genres, because it never had anything in the Soviet Union. So, yeah, sitcoms are suddenly really in. And the Russians are now writing them themselves. The first, they were just buying them and copying them shot for shot. Now they started writing them themselves, and they're actually very, very funny. So, yeah, sitcoms are big. But it was funny when they were just translating them from the West. They did Married with Children. Huge success in Russia. And they bought it from Sony, and Sony consultants came over and taught them how to do every shot. And, you know, the hair of the wife had to be exactly the same and all this stuff. And it ended up with absurdities because, I don't know if you remember Married with Children,
Saw
it once. And there's a staircase in the middle of their house because they live in this sort of suburban, you know, two-story house. In Russia, nobody lives in houses. No middle-class family lives in houses. They'll live in apartments. So, you know, this typical Russian apartment had like a staircase in the middle of it because the Russian producers weren't allowed to change anything. And so it was just absolutely ridiculous. It was just there are no two split level, you know, apartments in Russia unless you're incredibly rich. You know, there were these little absurdities that popped up. When you look at Russian TV now, if you go through it very, very quickly, you'll find basically this is the landscape. You'll find propaganda news, then propaganda history stuff, which is the same sort of thing, and then sitcoms. So sitcoms are just everywhere at the moment. And it's sort of, I think sitcoms are great, but I think when you only have sitcoms, when society is just sort of like filled with this fake canned laughter all the time, I think that's quite worrying. A society that is only watching sitcoms and propaganda news is in a pretty weird place, I think.
Peter Pomerantsev is a TV producer based in England. He wrote about his time in Russia for the London Review of Books. Steve Paulson spoke with him. For people who love ballet, there is nothing like Russian dance. Of course, there are other national ballet traditions, but for decades, centuries even, the Russian school dominated. Many of ballet's biggest stars were Russian. Think of Nijinsky and Baryshnikov. Many of today's most popular ballets are Russian, too, like Swan Lake and The Nutcracker. Jennifer Homans grew up with ballet and performed professionally. Today, she's the dance critic for The New Republic and the author of an acclaimed new history of ballet called Apollo's Angels. She told Anne Strange Champs what makes The Nutcracker one of the world's most popular ballets.
What's magical about The Nutcracker is its score. It wasn't a spectacular choreography or anything, but the score was just a pleasure at every moment to move to. So I think that score is part of what makes The Nutcracker endure. But of course, The Nutcracker is also part of that story of Russian ballet coming to, in this case, the U.S., and becoming American. You know, one of the first Nutcrackers, not the first, but one of the first, was George Balanchine, the Nutcracker, in the 1950s. And he had seen the ballet in Russia when he was a child, and he remembered it. And we can even look back and see that there are some things that he lifted directly from, you know, the choreography that he saw as a child.
Really? And, like what?
And recreated. Well, for example, one of the things that was so striking to me was when you see a picture of the early 1892 Nutcracker in St. Petersburg, the snowflakes are dressed almost identically to the New York City Ballet snowflakes in the 1950s, with little pom-poms and white skirts. And, you know, you might say, okay, well, that's just the idea of snow. But it really is a very striking similarity with one very notable exception, which is that Balanchine put little imperial crowns on his dancers as if to make the point that he had, that he was paying homage to that past that he had a lot of nostalgia for and admired greatly. Mm. So, you know, there, the Nutcracker has all of that history in it. And I think people can feel that when they go to see it.
And there's another Russian ballet that is in the popular mind again, Swan Lake. A lot of that thanks to the movie with Natalie Portman in it. What would you say is part of the brilliance of Swan Lake? I know you've written that, that one of the things that's so remarkable is the way the corps de ballet moves, that they move kind of as one during Swan Lake. Is that one of the things that's especially brilliant about it?
Yeah, I think Swan Lake is one of those things that is just, you know, it has so many elements and, you know, it has a great sort of internal life. It has an interiority that people can access, and that really comes from those lakeside scenes, the scenes you're talking about where the swans are all there and there's the corps de ballet and everybody's moving to this extraordinary music. And you have a sense of calm and peace and quiet and of an inner life. And then you also have, sort of in counterpoint to that, these very formal court scenes. So, you know, to me, what makes Swan Lake so special is the dancing more than the story. Mm. The story is a romantic tragedy, but it's not unusual or somehow very compelling. And often it's hard to follow in the ballet anyway, because ballets, you know, work through pantomime and you're not involved in the details of narrative. You're really just being washed by feeling and movement and music. It's nonverbal. It's a kind of almost instinctive experience.
You know, for many ballet lovers, Russian ballet isn't so much about the choreographer as it is about the dancers. If you think about the famous names, the Russian dancers Nijinsky and Nureyev and Baryshnikov, there's a kind of mystique to them. Why is that?
Well, I think the mystique, you know, is different in each case. You know, the mystique of Nijinsky is that he was an extraordinarily charismatic and powerful individual who had a technique, a dance technique, that I think was genuinely revolutionary. You know, Nijinsky was known for going, his sister writes, that he would go into a studio and he would do a classical ballet bar, but he would do it at an accelerated pace and with a kind of intense muscularity that he was trying to achieve something different. He also had a very unusual body, very thick, long thighs. His suits even had to be specially made to fit his thighs in because the standard sizes didn't work. A very long neck and sloping shoulders, long torso, actually not very long legs, shortish legs. So this was a kind of almost a grasshopper body that could just leap into the air and apparently, you know, to extraordinary effect. So there was that, but there was also, you know, part of the mystique was that when Nijinsky arrived in the early 20th century from Russia in Paris, the ballets that he did were, like Scheherazade, for example, were these kind of Russian, exotic, deliberately exotic dances that were very sexy and very erotic as well, so that, you know, all of that Russianness was, he was from the East, he was animal-like, he was, all of these kind of what we now think of as stereotypes were sort of attached to Nijinsky, and he played them to great effect. I think he knew exactly what he was doing. Mm. Nureyev did a little bit of that as well, but his sort of mystique and that of Baryshnikov as well, I think, come a lot from the Cold War. The fact that they defected, and they were, of course, tremendous artists without the Cold War, but the Cold War made them into something, into symbols of both of defection, of the desire for freedom, which dance could also express. You know, these were great dancers. They could fly. They were a symbol of how powerful Russia was at the same time as they were a symbol of, you know, how awful it was and people were leaving. So, you know, their fame and their dancing itself, I think, was, you know, sort of informed by this whole context.
Well, and then what a coup for the U.S.
What a coup for the U.S.
To have
right.
these great artists come and bring the power of their art to the U.S.
That's right.
Speaking of the Cold War, you write really interestingly that that dance actually flourished in Stalinist Russia, that in, for some strange reason, the repressive police state actually wound up creating good conditions for ballet. You would think that would not be the case.
Everything that logic has would say that, you know, when the Russian Revolution came, ballet should have gone because it was absolutely a symbol of court culture. And indeed, the theater originally in 1917 was ransacked and the imperial insignia were torn down. And there was a lot of debate in the country at the time over what should happen to ballet. And there were people who thought that it should just end and, you know, there shouldn't be any funding for it and it should just go away. But there were also people like Lunacharsky, who was the culture minister under Lenin, and he really believed in the older art forms, and he believed that, you know, that the proletariat could take these over and make them into something of their own. And so he was almost single-handedly actually very responsible for maintaining the opera houses at that time in Moscow and in St. Petersburg, well, in Leningrad as it became. And then, you know, what really happened over that revolutionary period into the Stalinist period is that, you know, the Russians decided, the Soviets decided that ballet was the perfect people's art. Here was an art form that you didn't need to be literate in order to appreciate it. Anybody could go. It was immediate. It was also very valuable as a diplomacy tool because no matter what language your visitor spoke, they could come to the ballet. Mm-hmm. And it was a sort of great Russian tradition that could be transformed into a revolutionary tradition, so that there were a lot of ballets made in the 30s that were then called tractor ballets. You know, they were about workers. And
well, that sounds like an oxymoron.
I know, it does indeed. But here they were. You know, they were on farms and making with shiny tools and making communism work. And these were portrayals of Soviet society as it should be. So the sort of idealism of ballet, the natural aspirations and the sense of wanting to be more noble were kind of transposed into a Soviet ideology quite successfully.
The end of your book, the end of your book is kind of sad. You write about your doubts about whether ballet will continue to survive, or at least whether it will continue to be a living art. Why are you so pessimistic about the future of ballet?
You know, it's funny. I'm not actually that pessimistic, but I do think that we're in a moment now of cultural decline. And, you know, it's not just ballet. It's kind of across the arts. But ballet is very particular because it has this kind of you know, it has a certain ethic to it. It has a kind of moral geometry. It aspires to nobility. The things that ballet is about are things that run against the culture today. You know, we're very interested in things that are messy, uneven, that don't cohere, that are fragmented and broken and kitschy, and you know, all of this kind of. There are questions of taste in a way. Our taste today is not necessarily the values and the kind of taste that ballet has. You know, that said, I don't see any reason at all why somebody can't sort of mobilize the sort of cultural impulses that we have into another great ballet moment. There's no reason that can't happen. I just don't think it's happened yet. And that's what I was trying to say. In a way, it's a historical point. You know, if you look back over the last 400 years, as I did in this book, and remember that the epilogue is the epilogue to the book. It's not just a freestanding essay. It's really meant as a historical marker to say that there are times and places in the course of the history of ballet when it's mattered tremendously. Russia in the 19th century, America in the 20th century, Britain in the 20th century, France in the 17th and 18th centuries. You know, and there are times and places where it falls away and it isn't as important. And I think we're kind of in one of those moments where it's fallen away a bit.
Jennifer Homan studied with Balanchine at the American Ballet Theater and performed professionally.
She's the dance critic for The New Republic and distinguished scholar in residence at New York University. Apollo's Angels, A History of Ballet, was listed as one of the 10 best books of 2010. She spoke with Anne Strainchance. What's your favorite Russian cultural export? Stop by our website and let us know. You can leave us a comment when you're there. It's ttbook.org, and we always look forward to hearing from you. Coming up, a writer gets up close and personal with Siberia. I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International.
Support for To the Best of Our Knowledge comes from the University of Wisconsin System eCampus, providing access to online degree programs and certificates offered by the 26 campuses of the UW system. Information is at ecampus.wisconsin.edu.
Nobody has ever formally laid out the boundaries of the actual physical Siberia. Rather, they were established by custom and accepted by general agreement. Siberia is, of course, huge. Three-fourths of Russia today is Siberia. Siberia takes up one-twelfth of all the land on Earth. The United States, from Maine to California, stretches across four time zones. In Siberia, there are eight. The contiguous United States, plus most of Europe, could fit inside it. Across the middle of Siberia, latitudinally, for 3,600 miles, runs the Russian taiga, the largest forest in the world. The Ural Mountains, which cross Russia from the Arctic Ocean to Kazakhstan, are the western edge of Siberia. The Urals also separate Europe from Asia. As a mountain range with the big job of dividing two continents, the Urals aren't much. It is possible to drive over them, as I have done, and not know. In central Russia, the summits of the Urals average between 1,000 and 2,000 feet. But after you cross the Urals, the land opens out, the villages are farther apart, the concrete bus shelters along the highway become fewer, and suddenly you realize you're in Siberia.
Ian Fraser, reading from his book Travels in Siberia. Siberia is vast, and writer Ian Fraser's crossed it all, from the Baltic Sea to the Pacific Ocean, with two guides in a broken-down van. Over the years, Fraser's made several trips to Russia, and he fell in love with the place, reluctantly. He calls it the greatest horrible country.
It is a great country, both physically and, I guess you could say, spiritually, artistically, culturally, politically, in all those ways. It's been, well, it's great. It's like America. It's a continental country. And it's had a great effect in the affairs of the world, certainly in my lifetime. But it's also just a benighted, wretched, miserable country in many ways. It's another way that I describe it is, and this refers to the Mongols who dominated Russia for about three centuries, that Russia is like an abused country. It was abused in its childhood by the Mongols. This was back starting in the 13th century. So it's a combination of splendor, really, and wretchedness.
The thing that's sort of the core of your book is a cross-country trip you took. What were you hoping to find when you went on that trip?
Well, I wanted to see things on the ground, and I wanted to see things close up. Many people had crossed Siberia on the Siberian Railway and had written about it. I wanted to do something more that was slower, that gave me the opportunity to go all kinds of different places. And I was hoping, I guess, just to accomplish that cross-country trip. It was something that exists. It does exist in books going back to the 17th century. People would cross Siberia to go to Peking, They would leave from Moscow and head all the way across that region and then wrote books about it. And I wanted to be in that genre of people who had crossed it. And just crossing it on the train didn't seem like enough. And flying across it, I might as well be sitting in my living room almost. I mean, not quite. Aeroflot is a little bit less, back then was a little bit less comfortable. But I wanted to see it up close, and I wanted to talk to people, and I wanted to wade in the swamp. It's a huge swamp in its western part. I wanted to see what that was like.
People have been sent to Siberia for a long time.
Right.
The prison camps are the things that we've heard about. Did you go looking for them?
I did. From the beginning, it was a natural thing to try and find. My guides were not keen on finding them. They like to look on the upside, and there is upside there. You know, there's beautiful, huge rivers, and, you know, they knew that there were good things, and they sort of pointed me to that. But I wanted always, I kept saying, you know, I've got to see some prisons. And they resisted that. But then finally, I did see prisons. I was on a winter trip, and I went to the far north of Yakutia, which is a place as big as India, with a population of about 1 million, whereas India has whatever, I don't know, 300,
more than
400
that.
Million. More than that, I forget. But it's a huge frozen north area, which had all these gulags in Stalin times.
Were they what you expected when you got there?
They were. They were very much like what you would read about in One Day in the Life of Ivan Denisovich, or what you would see in, what you would picture. And these were Stalin-era gulags, and they had been abandoned after Stalin died. So they had been basically just sitting there in cold storage since 1953, 1954. Because it's cold, because they're frozen, they were pretty well preserved. Hmm. So it was eerie walking into this just totally deserted gulag camp with barbed wire and guard towers and barracks and, you know, it was like all of Siberia really was like a prison during the worst of the Stalin years. It was a closed part of Russia.
There are some fascinating stories from the past that you uncovered. The Decembrists, for instance, who are kind of charming in a way. These are Tsarist officers who helped defeat Napoleon.
Right. They had been the officers for Alexander I as he pushed Napoleon all the way back and defeated him. They had saved Europe. They had a triumphant march down the Champs-Élysées. And then they went back to Russia, and repression again clamped down on them, and they decided they were going to overthrow the Tsar. And they attempted to in an uprising in December of 1825, and it was crushed. They failed. They were very disorganized, very romantically impractical. And over 100 of them were sent to Siberia. So a lot of what I did was I found places where they had been sent, and I looked into what their lives had been like in Siberia. In a way, they were very good for Siberia. They raised the tone of Siberia, if you want.
They lived to incorporate their ideals within their very limited circumstances.
Right. They treated each other well, and that's what you sort of have to love them for. They were the first sort of official people, even though they were prisoners. They were the first upper-class people, I guess, who appeared in Siberia not as oppressors, that is, in relation to how they treated the local people. So they learned a lot about Siberia. They did a lot of ethnography. They introduced new plants. They built schools. They had a kind of good effect. And they also suffered horribly. They were far from home. Their children died in childhood, many of them. I mean, it was a rough place to live. It was like a suffering experience that ennobled them, truly. And Russians to this day think warmly of the Decembrists. In fact, if you go back through Russian history, it's hard to find anybody that people say, oh, that guy was really great. But people love the Decembrists still.
You spent a lot of time there, and you actually looked for and found the road that the exiled walked.
Right.
That must have been an extraordinary experience.
Well, the road is still there. I mean, in places you can see the ruts. It's called the Sibirsky Tract. It's a road that you can find pictures of it in 19th century travel books or sketches of it. And it was just ruts that were worn into the ground. And these were people walked. Many people who were exiled to Siberia had to walk there. And they were walking along in chains. So you can sort of picture these convicts walking along. And then all of empire went up and down that road, you know, from imperial couriers to tea caravans. Russia's a great tea-drinking country, and it used to get its tea from China in these huge caravans of tea carts that would come, you know, thousands and thousands of miles along this road. And I loved seeing those ruts. I'm what is called a rut nut. I used to go check out ruts of the Santa Fe Trail and of the Oregon Trail in, you know, the West. Something about it, you look at that rut and you think, wow, think of all the people that passed along it.
You know, we've talked about how hard life was for many in Siberia, and some of it sounds so bleak and inspiring in the wrong way that I think we had to talk a little bit about the beauty of it, because you did find it an inspiring place in more positive terms, too. The lake you grew to love, Lake Baikal.
Well, Lake Baikal has a reputation as, you know, the jewel of Russia, really, and the reputation is deserved. It's just a kind of mystical and beautiful place. The water is clear beyond any clear water I've ever seen.
Isn't that the one that's supposed to be the deepest lake in the world?
Yes, it is. And it's and it has, I don't know, a sixth of all the fresh water on Earth or something like that. It's actually a lake created by the expansion, by continental drift, a continent's pulling apart. And it's this kind of, I think it's called a rift lake. Anyway, it's a north-south, runs roughly north-south. It's beautiful in the summer, and then once it freezes, gets, I don't know, like 9 meters of ice or something, it gets a very thick ice surface, and people drive on it. And just driving up the middle of Lake Baikal on this road as straight as a string right across this white expanse of the lake is really just kind of a dazzling experience, and a cold one. It's quite cold in the winter there.
As an American going to Russia, did you find you think of it now as a different kind of place than you did before?
Yes, I think of it, I guess, in a funny way, with more tenderness. I mean, a place gets a reputation, and then you go there and you kind of think, you know, this is just a place. It's just another part of the earth. People who live there sometimes are really happy. I mean, they have a kind of independent existence that you find less often in Russia, sort of like, you know, frontier people, the reputation frontier people have everywhere. But they're really friendly. You know, people were really nice. They were interested to hear about America. For many people who I met, I was the first American they had ever seen in the flesh, although they'd seen plenty of Americans on TV and in movies. But I found it to be a welcoming place in many parts of it, and a rich place, you know, ecologically rich, rich in terms of its minerals and its fresh water. I mean, it's got endless reserves of that. There's something of great potential about it that attracts me, I guess, as an American, because we think of our country always as having potential. And this is potential. It's like it might seem it's going to never be tapped. But I ended up with affection for it, for sure.
Well, thank you, Ian Fraser.
You're welcome.
Ochen horsho.
Spasibo bolsho.
Ian Fraser is a frequent contributor to The New Yorker and the author of Travels in Siberia. Coming up, the Cold War, Hollywood style. I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. The decades-long Cold War gave America the Atomic Age, the McCarthy era, and the House Un-American Activities Committee. That and a legacy of movies that both captured and helped create the time. Jim Hoberman is the senior film critic for The Village Voice. He writes about the films of the early Cold War in the book An Army of Phantoms, American Movies and the Making of the Cold War. He told Ann Strange Champs he thinks one of the most definitive Cold War films is The Next Voice You Hear.
God gets on the radio for 6 nights and speaks directly to the American people in somewhat the same way that FDR might have delivered his fireside chats, except, of course, you never hear the voice of God. You only get it through people's descriptions, or sometimes, you know, they write down what he says or paraphrases it.
What is it, Joe?
It was a kind of a funny thing on the radio just now. They announced it was exactly 8:30, and there was a kind of a funny empty sound. And then a voice said, "This is God. I'll be with you for the next few days."
Well, then what happened?
Nothing happened. The program came back on.
Well, it must be one of those mystery voice shows. You know, you have to guess whose voice.
I usually tell you about the prizes first.
Or maybe one of those Orson Welles things.
Yeah.
Just as an aside, I have to say how very pleased I am that out of all the media, God chose radio.
Yes, and also one of the things that's very striking about this movie, which was released in the early summer of 1950, is that television is one of many significant things that are not mentioned.
Why do you think of this as a Cold War movie?
Well, for one thing, there's the tremendous anxiety behind it, you know, the desire, even the fantasy of this kind of divine intervention. And then I think that it's maybe difficult for us to imagine the impact that the atomic bomb had on people's consciousness in the, you know, years immediately following World War II. I mean, we've had a long time to adjust to it, if in fact we have, which, you know, is questionable. But then it really did seem to people that they could be living in the latter days. And significantly, God then began to play a very crucial part in American public life, which had really had not happened before, despite what people say now. There's a historical basis for this. I mean, Eisenhower ran in 1952, not just as somebody who had been the supreme commander of the Allied forces during World War II, but as a deeply religious man who had practically been called upon by God to become president. And the fact that his parents were Jehovah's Witnesses and thus, you know, would have been acutely aware of the separation between church and state is not something which, you know, seemed to have affected him. He was baptized in the White House, and he's the one who got In God We Trust put on the money and One Nation Under God inserted into the Pledge of Allegiance. Mm. And so in the early 50s, God really came back. I mean, the communists were routinely described as godless communists, which meant that as their opposites, we had to be godful Americans.
You also write about, during this period, you write about High Noon as, in some ways, an example of one response. It was made by a screenwriter who was an unfriendly witness before HUAC, right?
High Noon is the best-known example of a movie that allegorizes the blacklist. Although it didn't start out that way. I mean, what happened was that Carl Foreman, who had been a communist, was a screenwriter and producer, and he was subpoenaed while he was writing the movie. And he was struck and appalled by the fact how when people heard about this, they sort of ran from him. And eventually, you know, he lost his place in the company that put out High Noon. But he saw the movie as being a metaphor for the blacklist where only one guy in the town, the marshal, Gary Cooper, is willing to stand up against outlaws and everybody else turns their face away or runs away and so on.
A terror-stricken town left him to face four killers, single-handed, at High Noon. With every swing of the pendulum, with every second, a man's life ticked away. Never have so few moments held such excitement.
And one of the reasons why other people came to see the movie that way, because not everybody did, is because Forman wrote to Bosley Crowther, the film critic for the New York Times then, and told him that that's what he was doing. Told him the backstory, that this was what the movie was about. And, you know, Forman did testify. He was essentially an unfriendly witness. I mean, he was willing to tell the committee that he had been a communist, but he wasn't going to name anybody else. And as a result, he was driven into exile.
Wow. That's such an interesting reading of the film. I guess I hadn't realized that. I've always thought it was just a classic, one of the classic Westerns, you know, small town marshal and a Western frontier. It never occurred to me it would have any connection to the HUAC experience.
Yeah. Well, of course, it did become the classic Western in a way. And it's a movie which is very much beloved by American politicians. It's the movie that's been shown the most in the White House. I mean, starting with Dwight D. Eisenhower, who screened it three times, through Clinton, who claimed it was his favorite movie and showed it evidently 20 times while he was president, and then made a point of telling Dan Rather that he was going to recommend it to George W. Bush.
Did any filmmakers make explicitly pro-communist or anti-capitalist movies? Did any just say, all right, I've already been blacklisted, now I'm going to make what I want?
There's only one example of blacklisted writers and directors and producers getting together to make a movie, and that's The Salt of the Earth, which was made in New Mexico in 1953 and concerns a strike by a miners' union there. And it was made hand-to-mouth and with a tremendous amount of government interference, and not even covert government interference. I mean, the making of this movie became an issue on the floor of Congress, and there were all kinds of articles in the press suggesting that the movie was being financed by the Soviets, that the whole thing was an elaborate cover to spy on Los Alamos or, you know, like disrupt the uranium mines and so on. It's fantastic to read about this.
What's the plot of the movie?
The movie is a story of a strike. It's a very straightforward story of a strike, which involves mainly Mexican-American workers and how the mine owners attempt to break the strike. And people suffer, but in the end prevail. They're the salt of the earth. And, you know, it's a kind of a very straightforward sort of 1930s, you know, popular front narrative. And there's no mention of communism in the movie.
The men quarreled. They made brave speeches. It seemed the strike was lost.
Brother Chairman, if you read the court injunction carefully, you will see that it only prohibits striking minors from picketing. We women are not striking minors. We will take over your picket line. Don't laugh. We have a solution. You have none. If women take your places on the picket line, the strike will not be broken, and no scabs will take your job.
Now, another film genre that came of age during this time, really was invented during this time, is science fiction films, which you could see as simply a response to the atomic bomb, the, you know, creation of this whole new science and the fear about atomic science. You write about it also, though, as a reflection of Cold War fears.
Science fiction was a genre which seemed something that, rather than being about the future, was about this new situation that the human race found ourselves in after the end of the war. And something which is a parallel to this is the flying saucer mania, which is also a historical thing. I mean, it begins in the summer of 1947 and continues more or less for another 5 or 6 years, where there were all these saucer sightings and so on. I think that Invasion of the Body Snatchers is the classic B-movie allegory of the period.
A moment's sleep and the girl I loved was an inhuman enemy bent on my destruction. That moment's sleep was death to Becky's soul, just as it had been for Jack and Teddy and Dan Kaufman and all the rest. Their bodies were now hosts harboring an alien form of life, a cosmic form, which to survive must take over every human man. My only hope was to get away from Santa Mira, to get to the highway, to warn the others of what was happening.
Look! You fools! You're in danger! You're next! You're next! You're...
What's fascinating about Invasion of the Body Snatchers, aside from the fact that it's, that to this day it's a very effective movie, it works very well, very, very well directed and acted film, is that it has two readings. I mean, the movie was conceived and made by liberals, some of whom who had been communists, at least one of whom had been a communist who then turned around and named names. So it was made by people who experienced the Red Scare up close. And for them, it was a critique of conformity.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like the suburbs, the man in the gray flannel suit, even McCarthyism was seen as a kind of conformist attitude, and just the danger that Americans surrendered their individual liberties and so on. But once the movie was out there, it was understood, not surprisingly, and first in Europe, as an allegory about, you know, that had to do with the fear of communism. And the thing that's in a way even more revealing is that to a large degree, when it opened, and it was not a hit at all. I mean, it was never even reviewed in the New York Times. Didn't open in a theater in Manhattan. Was that a lot of people just didn't get it? I mean, Variety reviews this movie, and they can't figure out what the premise is. You know. So it's like adding another level of denial to this thing. I mean, then, of course, it went on to become a tremendous, you know, a cult favorite, thanks to television mainly.
Jim, thanks so much for talking today.
Oh, you're very welcome.
Jim Homberman is the senior film critic at The Village Voice and the author of An Army of Phantoms. He spoke with Anne Strangechamps. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. If you want to hear this program again, check an author's name, or find out about a piece of music we used, visit our website. It's ttbook.org. To buy a copy of the program, call the radio store at 1-800-747-7444. Ask for program number 417A, Made in Russia. To the Best of Our Knowledge is produced at Wisconsin Public Radio. This hour was produced by Veronica Rickert, with help from Anne Strangechamps, Doug Gordon, and Charles Monroe Kane. Our executive producer is Steve Paulson. Our technical director is Kirill Owen. You can stream To the Best of Our Knowledge on our website at ttbook.org, where you will also find a link to the weekly podcast.
PRI, Public Radio International.